Welcome to Bits About Books, the home for conversations with authors of breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. Founders, entrepreneurs, and individual professionals, we all need to keep track of ideas that are helping create our today and tomorrow. Bits About Books will strive to find those books and speak to their authors, go behind the scenes and understand what inspired the authors to write the books that they did and how they went about doing so. Through our conversations, we hope to gain insights that will help us to get the most out of our efforts. I'm your host Shubhanjan Sarkar, founder of PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform, where our mission is to make buying easy. Thank you for your time and for joining us in this session. I have a favor to ask. While you continue to listen to the podcast, please leave a comment or rating at iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts from. It means a lot to hear from you. Today, we have with us Juan David Campolargo, author of Generation Optimism.
Last year, I realized that my generation, which is Gen Z, is one of the most pessimistic generations in the history of humankind. And that's not something I'm saying out of nowhere. There's research and surveys that I'll be happy to send you. So I realized that. And that is crazy to me because we are literally living in the best time ever in the history of humankind. So why this book? Why optimism? So I'm a person who was actually very optimistic despite some difficulties that I had early on my life. And however, I continue to be optimistic, and I see optimism as a way to change the world. When I was very young, my dad was murdered, and he was killed. And the other thing that after that we have to move to the U.S. and that was super hard. So I was born in Venezuela, and so we have to move to the U.S. And it was super hard too. I moved to the U.S. in 2016, and I didn't know any English, nothing. If you would have said to me hello or something, I would not have understood a single word of it. So I decided to start writing this book in 2019. So that was only about 2 or 3 years after I moved here. So by the time, my English was pretty good. So the book is pretty much composed by my story, interviews, and research. There's a lot of research and data.
Juan is an unwavering optimist and go-getter. 3 years ago, he moved to Naperville from Venezuela, having not spoken any English. 6 months later, he had learned enough English to enroll in advanced placement and honors courses at his high school, and that was just the start. He founded the digital marketing consultancy Optimum Smart to evaluate personal and corporate brands. Juan speaks 4 languages, including Chinese. He serves on Naperville's Downtown Advisory Committee, contributes to PANS and Chicago, a nonprofit providing assistance to Venezuelan immigrants. He also manages Campolargo Holdings, a small hedge fund. He is a 2-time TEDx speaker and author of Generation Optimism, which shares his ideas on creating the next generation of doers and dreamers in a society plagued by pessimism. He will graduate high school in 2020. Now listen to this super optimistic episode of Bits About Books with Juan David Campolargo. Juan David, welcome to Bits About Books. I'm really excited to talk to you. I mentioned to you as we were speaking and getting ready for this recording that you are the youngest guest ever to make into my show. And I'm very honored to have you here. I am very keen to know what drives you and what made you write this book now. Welcome.
Thank you so much. That's really exciting. I'm really excited and thrilled to be here. So thank you for the opportunity, and I can't wait to tell your listeners and you about the book, and let's have fun.
Yep. So first things first, why this book and why now?
Last year, I realized that my generation, which is Gen Z, is one of the most pessimistic generations in the history of humankind. And that's not something I'm saying out of nowhere. There's research and surveys that I'll be happy to send you. So I realized that, and that is crazy to me, because we are literally living in the best time ever in the history of humankind. Sure, we have the virus, we have all of this, we have this and that, but I would rather have this virus now than 100 years ago or 200 years ago, right? Sure, it's impacting us really badly, but we're going to find a way more easily than 100 years ago, 50 years ago. So the world's in every aspect of life, education, whatever, technology is getting better. It continues to get better. So why this book? Why optimism? So I'm a person who was actually very optimistic despite some difficulties that I had early on my life. And however, I'm continuing to be optimistic, and I see optimism as a way to change the world. I see optimism as a way to change the world, because the optimists are the only ones who are going to try to do something and solve and do something about the problems that we have. I'll give you an example. The optimists are the only ones who are trying to solve and do something about this current virus. When you are optimistic, you might fail. That's for sure. But you are at least going to try and do something about it. While as the pessimists and the other people are just complacent, just lazy. And when you're lazy, when you're complacent, you do nothing. And that's where problems really get started. But really, I see optimism as a way to change the world.
There are parallel research which says that maybe pessimists are not really pessimists. But someone in your generation, Greta Thunberg, she's very concerned, and she might appear to be pessimistic to many. And she has been very vocal about her pessimism about our generation. So how do
right,
you...
Well, I mean, I think, yeah, go ahead.
No. So what do you think about that?
That's different. I mean, I consider her a very optimistic person. I'll give you an example. If she wasn't pessimistic, she would not be doing all of that she's doing, right? If she was pessimistic, she would say, I can't do nothing about this. Like, what is going to do a 16-year-old girl or 17-year-old girl to go up against governments and authorities? And what is she going to do? If she wasn't optimistic, she would definitely not be doing all of that she's doing. And in one of my TED Talks, I talk about, I introduce a concept of the optimism scale. Because when people think of optimism, they think it's either binary. It's like it's either you are pessimistic or optimistic. But in reality, there are different scales. And I talk about how the number seven, being in the number seven, is the right point to be optimistic. So you have optimism, extreme optimism number 10, and extreme pessimism number 1. In both ends, you do nothing, right? But in the number 7, it's the right point where you're able to be concerned enough to do something about it, and it make an impact, right? So that's the number 1 thing, because people think optimism is delusional and just thinking it's just going to get better naturally. But that's not really what optimism is. At its core, optimism is something else, and optimism is about doing and about change, about impacting society. And most of society get that wrong.
Great, because when you are talking about how we are living in the best of times, I don't know whether you follow Hans Rosling. He's no more, but Hans Rosling wrote this book called Factfulness, and he had a 13-question quiz, which people across the board fail, because they cannot predict how good the times are compared to what it was earlier, and how we have this overriding sense of pessimism and naysaying which says that this is the worst of times. We have lived for nearly 70 years without any major war across the world. I quite echo what you are thinking. So
and just one more point quickly. And it doesn't mean like we're just better, like we're just the best, and it's only going to, the best is only to get here. Of course, there's room for more improvement. But what we need to realize and get perspective is that we're way better than the past. We're way better. However, there are still a lot of places that we can improve. So there's this guy who talks about the stagnation of progress. His name is Peter Thiel. He's a famous investor. He started PayPal. He also invested in Facebook, the first investor in Facebook, actually. And he talks a lot about the stagnation of progress and how we haven't done a lot of work in the world of atoms, in science, in physics, in biology, and all of that. And that's concerning. However, that's something that we need to improve. And the optimists are the ones who are going to try to do something about it in that regard, which the world has improved in a lot of aspects, in computers and technology and all of this, but not so much in the world of science. And that's not perfect. And if you're truly optimistic, you're going to say, hey, that's not perfect. Why don't we do something about it, right? And you say, science is just going to get better naturally. Like, let's just wait for Einstein to come back or something. That's not really optimism. Like, that's delusion. And that's not what I'm trying to say.
You just mentioned that you went through some difficulties in your life. I mean, you're 16 years old. I do not know what difficulties you went through, which made you sort of, or provoked you to write this book.
In a way, not really. I just wanted to share. I wanted to, in a way, to inspire people to have a different perspective of someone who's just like them, right? And if you want to know what those difficulties are, I could tell you here, but it's a little long. But so one of those is that when I was very young, my dad was murdered, and he was killed. And the other thing that after that we have to move to the U.S. and that was super hard. So I was born in Venezuela, and so we have to move to the U.S. and it was super hard too.
I'm sorry to hear that. Really,
no worries. But if you really want to get more detail, like my tech talk, it's the best place to go.
Sure. Let's move on. So how did you, when you thought that you're going to write this book, Juan David, how did you start the process?
So, like I said before, I moved to the US in 2016, and I didn't know any English, nothing. If you would have said to me hello or something, I would not have understood a single word of it. So I decided to start writing this book in 2019. So that was only about 2 or 3 years after I moved here. So by the time, my English was pretty good. But I've never written a book before. So like, I don't know. I used to learn English, and I've never written a book before. Like, I'm not like an author or whatever. Someone introduced me a Georgetown professor, a Georgetown University professor who was my mentor and helped me through this process. And that's how the journey got started. And he didn't write a book with me per se, but he was a mentor to me. He helped me find a publisher and all of this. And that's how the journey got started. I had the opportunity to. So the book is pretty much composed by my story, interviews, and research. There's a lot of research and data. And one of the interviews that I was able to do was with the entrepreneur Mark Cuban. which is he is a billionaire, and he's also the owner of the Maverick, and he participates in the short Shark Tank. And that's how he got started. But honestly, it's super hard. It seems hard, but you only have to get started. And I didn't know how to write a book. Now I do. And I didn't before. So
what was your routine like? I mean, you are reaching out to people like Mark Cuban. He's not an easy man to get through to. You are doing research. You are structuring the book that I'm going to have this 10, 11 chapters, and this is how we'll be part one. This will be part two. I'm thinking that this professor in Georgetown University helped you to structure your thoughts. But how did you go about doing it?
Right. So there's there's periods of divided by days and months, and there are certain days where you have to get the stories and the writing done, and then you go and reach out to people like this, which is, I'm telling you, it's super hard to reach out to people like Mark Cuban. And, you know, I also reach out to Ray Dalio. You know, I talked to him and everything, but he didn't really want to do the interview. So the first 3 months or so were writing, and I didn't have chapters or anything like that, because when you have chapters, you limit yourself to write only those things. So what I did, and what the professor suggested me to do, was just writing stories, just writing, whatever you want to write about. Of course, related to your topic, but just writing. And then after that, you kind of organize the same points and everything. And then after that, there's a period of 15 days, 2 weeks or so, where you try to find anything that is missing, or not as that is missing, but that you would like to complement to what you have written. And that's the point where you try to find interviews to add an interesting story of like Mark Cuban, which is super interesting. You have that, you have the opportunity to go to interviews, and then after that you have the period of research. And if you set a statistic or something, you find and back it up. And then there's a period of 3 to 4 months, and that you keep writing more. And then in those months, that's where you also create the chapters and organize the content into the chapter. And then you get advanced readers to give you feedback, and the editors, and...
And you are not thinking through this whole time that you need to find a publisher?
So the professor helped me find a publisher when we had the idea of the book. I had a 25,000 word manuscript, and that's when we sent the book to the publisher, and, you know, They reviewed it and everything. You got approved, and so you got approved before about 6 to 8 months before it got published, and that's where I have all my content and the interviews and everything. And then after you got approved, that's where I continue writing and continue to implement new, like, the chapters and everything that I told you before.
It's time for a short break. Juan wanted to reach out to Mark Cuban for his book. He didn't know him, yet he did get to interview Mark Cuban. If you want to know what and how, stay with us.
You are listening to a Business Podcast Network original. Podcasting is the fastest growing content marketing opportunity, which is untapped. We can help you craft your audio strategy and help leverage the wide reach and easy streaming capability that the smartphone penetration provides. It is easy, it is powerful, and personal. Talk to us to find out how podcasting can help you build your brand and reach out to your targets like never before. Write to us at bpn@bizcast.in. That is bpn@bizcast.in. Business Podcast Network. Podcasts end to end.
Welcome back. I'm your host, Shubhanjan Sarkar. Right before the break, Juan started narrating why he wanted to have Mark Cuban for his book and how he got to interview him. Here is the story. How did you get through to Mark Cuban? Why did you think you were going to talk to him? What prompted you, and what was the process, and what happened?
Yeah, so I wanted to interview him because he has so certain interesting in completing a story. So if you don't know anything about him, he was a very humble guy. When he was a teenager and before going to college, he was an entrepreneur. Like, he would sell garbage bags door to door where he lived, and it was really inspiring because he didn't have anything. He had nothing. And then he went to university, college, and then he started a company, and then he started another company, and then he sold that company for $1 billion, and that's how he was able to get to that place. But I knew that deep in there, in the beginning, he was a very optimistic person, because if he didn't, he would not have tried so many times to start his companies and do everything that he did, right? So I asked him, how do you think optimism has helped you in your journey, in your entrepreneurial journey? And he told me that it is that optimism has been the way to not only try, but it has helped him try it again. And, you know, once he's able to overcome that failure, he was only looking to, you know, understand why he failed, and then just keep moving forward, and trying again. So, and if he wasn't optimistic, he would not have been able to do that, right? And I wanted to interview him, and I had the chance to do so.
So, who else did you talk to who was very interesting for you?
Yes, I talked to some professors, not super well known, some entrepreneurs, but the most famous person was definitely him, right? But yeah, I talked to a lot of people as well.
And how did you go about doing the research in terms of whatever data you were trying to find? For example, you wrote a chapter on the psychology of optimism.
So how you go about it is that, you know, I knew I wanted to write about the psychology of optimism. That's something that I wanted to do for sure. So how do you go about it? Instead of going online and just trying to find information and doing whatever, what you do is that you have an outline and you have topics that you want to cover in the book, right? In the chapter, in this case. And, you know, you start with an outline and you have with the topics that you want to cover, right? So, and then you start writing, and then you use the research to complement what you think is missing in what the editors think and what the advanced readers think. Hey, maybe you should add data here, research data, and so on. And that's how you go about it. And then it's always, you know, I try to talk to the people who did the research and published them and try to get an interview. For example, there's a famous guy who came up with the Learn Optimism, right? He wrote a book about that, and it was super famous. His name is Martin Seligman. You know, I tried to talk to him because, you know, I use some of his books and the research and some of his research. And, you know, I wanted to talk to him, but, you know, he told me, we talked via email. Like, he replied to my email, but he told me that he didn't do interviews. But I tried. And that's how you go about it.
So let's talk about the book now. So the first question is, are you an optimist?
What do you think?
You tell me, Juan David.
I'm definitely an optimistic person. And like I said in the beginning, optimism is not binary. There are different scales. In what I consider myself is a 7. In 7 is a place where you are not, when we're optimistic enough to see where you need to improve and optimistic enough to make an impact in society and what you're trying to do.
So in your scale, 7 is the magic number.
That's exactly the description I used to do that. So I say 7 is a magic number. 7 is a number of colors of the rainbow. 7 is a number of days in the week. 7 is the day I was born, and I go from there.
Okay.
But 7 is a magic place.
Wonderful. So what do you think from your research and from the from what you wrote, why do you think, why do people like to be pessimists?
I don't think they like. It's mainly for two reasons. And so the first reason is that we have, that we're genetically wired to be negative and pessimistic. And the other reason is that, yeah, so we're genetically wired to be pessimistic. And the other reason is that most people, like, it's easier to be pessimistic. So let's go one by one. So how are you genetically wired to be pessimistic or not optimistic? Why is that, right? So in the beginning of the time, 2,000 years ago, way in the beginning, we needed to be negative in order to survive. I'll give you an example. Let's say there was a lion or a tiger right behind you. And, you know, you think it's an animal. It could be a person, you know, it could be something. What were you going to do? Be positive, optimistic, or negative, or pessimistic? You needed to be negative in order to survive. Because even if there was a person, you better thought it was a lion. Because if it really was a lion, you would have died. And you would not have survived. So negativity was our survival mechanism in order to survive. So that's what we needed to do. The second reason is that it's easier to be pessimistic. Just easier to be pessimistic. It takes no effort, it takes no energy. And optimism, on the contrary, it takes energy and takes work. It takes going against, not your nature, but kind of, right? It takes going against your nature and going to what you think it's right, right? But at its core, I think one of the most important reasons is that people, which is also very interesting, is that people confuse being pessimistic with realistic, right? You know, people, you know, a lot of people are just trying to say, I'm just a realist. And honestly, what they are, just pessimistic people who are afraid of what other people think. Because there's also this negative connotation that if you're pessimistic, you know, you're not a very good person, right? But in reality, a lot of people aren't pessimistic deep at its core. And I'm just a realist. Sure. You are just trying to hide who you are, right? And when I say that optimism, it's not that I'm trying to say, it's not that I'm trying to hide the reality. Of course not. I'm a super realistic person, right? I'm a super realistic person that sticks to the facts and to what is actually true. But the realists, they're just trying to be really and real negative and real pessimistic. So that's something that we need to really understand.
So you would not bring in people who call themselves pragmatic into this equation. You're not talking about pragmatic people, are you? Because pragmatic people are also somebody who is real about both the optimism and the realism and the pessimism, right? So they actually have a balanced view.
It's like I said, I mean, there's an optimism scale, and the pragmatic, as you say, it could be very, very well defined as optimistic. But I'd rather be optimistic and be wrong than pessimistic and right or pragmatic or whatever. Because if you're optimistic, you're going to have to try to have the vaccine by the end of the fall or whatever you say, like in the fall. And maybe you won't. But if you try, you might have it by October or November or something. So the pragmatic people might be right, but I'd rather be optimistic and have the vaccine as soon as possible, even though you might not. So
I was not trying to find problem with optimism. I was just trying to say that there are this group.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So it was more like that. So So my next question is, according to you, when you say learning to be optimistic, you are sort of implying that even if you're not optimistic by nature, you can turn yourself into an optimist at the scale number of 7.
The famous physicist Stephen Hawking said once, intelligence is the ability to adapt. And that is what we need to do in the 21st century and learn to adapt to be optimistic. We need to be smart enough to realize that optimism and being optimistic is better than being other type of things. And learning to be an optimistic person is something that you have to learn, you know, something that comes into you, into your dreams. And, you know, in the book, I talk about that, sure, there could be some portion of genetics, but it's so small that it's almost irrelevant. And a lot of the other things, such as, and, you know, there's a lot of other factors, such as the environment, the environment where you're in, what you consume, what you read, what you listen to. They affect a lot more the genetics into who you are as a person. So learning to be optimistic, you need to consider a few aspects to do so. And the most important one is that you have to realize that optimism does not come to us naturally. And once you're able to realize that, it's going to come a lot easier.
Got it. So why should your generation be thought of as an optimist generation?
It's not that it should be thought, is that Generation C is a very... Generation C, millennials, and most of the population are generally very pessimistic. And what I wanted to do with this book and what I wanted to do with what I've done is that I'm trying to offer them and show them and inspire them a different worldview of the world, a different perspective, and one that is optimistic. One of the things that I believe deeply and fundamentally believe in is that we need to be optimistic in order to solve the world challenges. The world in the future is going to have a lot of problems and difficulties. We're going to have things like AI, artificial intelligence, biotechnology, climate change. There are going to be a lot of problems and challenges. And now we're having one, the coronavirus. But if you're not optimistic, there's going to be a very few people who are going to try to solve those problems. And that's something that concerns me a lot. Because who are the ones who are trying to, you know, this one is a very good example with the coronavirus. Who are the ones who are trying to do something and solve them? You know, here in the U.S., there's a lot of people who are trying to come up with some masks. And, you know, me and some friends are trying to print some masks in our area to give for free to people who work at hospitals and stuff like that. And the optimists are the only ones who are going to try to do something about it and solve the world's challenges and difficulties. And that is something that concerns me, because if there's not a lot of people who can think more positively, if there's not a lot of optimists, that's something that concerns me, because we need more optimists.
So what is your formula of creating a generation of dreamers and doers? That's your final chapter in the book, right?
In the chapter in how to create the doers and dreamers in future generations as a whole, is that we need to change a lot of how we raise kids, right? And, you know, in there I talk a lot about how we're growing. Like, one of the most important things is that we're growing very complacent. Complacency and being very dependent to others. So if we're able to be not complacent, number one, and being independent, number two, I think those are the most important things to create the next generation of doers and dreamers. So if we're able to be independent, if we're able to have energy and being not complacent about things, those two things, nothing else, those two things are the most important things to do that. And, you know, I talk a lot about how I was an example of how I was raised to be a very independent person. And, you know, I talk a lot about how my mom, which basically now helped me do my homework. Just little stuff like that, which is homework is just irrelevant. Like, homework is nothing. It's very important because how your parents help you and, you know, teach you how to do things is important. And if you're older and you're dependent in a way, it doesn't matter. Like, you can just go back and, like, tell your mom, hey, like, do not help me with my homework. What you can do is that you can try to be more independent instead of telling a friend, hey, help me this. Just try and do it yourself. I'm not trying to say that you should be an individualist. What I'm trying to say is that you can try to be more independent when it comes to problem solving. And that's a very important thing when it comes to creating that future generation.
So what kind of role do you think schools can play? Because there is a lot of talk about the current schooling system, which essentially the way it is run, most of the world, is killing creativity of children. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, don't get me started. Yeah, the educational system it's interesting. I mean, it's very, the harm that it's doing, it's almost, it almost outweighs the positive that it does, right? And I think one of the most important things that, you know, I'm actually writing an essay about it that I'm going to publish on Sunday. So if you like to read it, just go to my website, juandavidcampolargo.blog. So in there, I talk about how one of the things that school tells you is that we can think for ourselves. And that is a lie, because no one can think for herself. Our thinking process is a collection when we read, watch, and listen. So for example, when we try to write a paper, an essay in school, what they tell us to do is that research, read something, and then write a paper about it. What the paper is going to be is not going to be your thoughts. It's going to be what you just read. And then what the teacher is going to tell you is that you are able to think independently of others, but no one can, because of our thinking process. We cannot just make up a thought or an idea. Our ideas and thoughts and processes are a collection of our environment and a lot of our thinking processes.
What else have we missed? What else would you like to talk about the book?
You said that like we should come back to it, and that is one of the things that we're not very good at, it is that the progress and the stagnation of progress in. And I think that's something that we need to understand and not be confused by. So the world, in every aspect, no matter what, it's improving. And that's something that we need to understand and get more perspective on, right? So when we are able to understand the fact that the world is improving in every aspect, and in there I have a chapter about how the world has improved and everything, and that's actually the second chapter, because I wanted to have that for people to understand very quickly. Once you're able to understand that, you're very good to go and understand the journey of the book. So that's something that is very important. And however, it doesn't mean that we're the best and that we're not able to improve anymore. No. What that means is that we have a lot more to improve in the future. And if we want to get to the place of improvement, and if we want to get that place to where we're able to have that life that we want to get, we need to do a lot of things. And one of the things is that we need to be able to think differently and have and dream. You know, the book is how to create those dreamers, right? And we need to want those things, you know. There's a lot of things that we thought we were going to have, such as flying cars. Where are they? Like, it's 2020. What are those cars? You know, way before in the 20th century, people thought that the 21st century, we're going to have these cars, the flying cars. They are not here, and they're not going to be here for a while. What happened? And, you know, those little things that we thought were very, you know, we are a very technological world, but in reality, we're better and we're going to get better, but we need to do more and get to those things. And you need to want those things. You want to dream big enough to get those things and being able to be optimistic enough to do that. I think it's the perfect formula.
Bits About Books is brought to you by PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. PitchLink makes buying easy by enabling high-quality engagement between buyers and sellers through its presentation and discussion modules. Sellers create customized sales narratives using sales collaterals and personal videos and reach out to prospects through a non-intrusive, buyer-qualified engagement. PitchLink requires no installation or download and holds the entire repository of sales collaterals and buyer-seller conversations. Talk to us to know more about how you can engage with customers without intrusion. Call us on 99021-631-32.
Wonderful. One, David, it was lovely speaking with you. I wish you all success and I hope your book is doing very well, and I would look forward to talking to you again.
Likewise. Thank you so much for having me, and I hope to, you know, talk to you again, and thank you so much.
Coming up in the next episode is another fantastic conversation with Melanie Daziel on her book, The Content Fuel Framework.
Yeah, I mean, I wish I could go back to the very beginning and figure out when I first fell in love with stories. But I think it's sort of been in my DNA, in my personality since the very beginning. You know, my parents said that when I was a baby, I always wanted to be reading books. You know, I was really interested in stories, even as a baby. I think most of us are, right? But I studied journalism. You know, what I loved about journalism was that every story that I was assigned was an invitation to become an expert in something new. You know, I could go and interview experts and study something and check out the research on it and then get to turn around and share that with other people. You know, really kind of, it was like teaching, but also being a student at the same time, you know? And I loved that from a knowledge gathering and sharing standpoint. And so what I found is that there was a lot of need for that kind of skill and that kind of sensibility in the marketing world, you know, that we needed to sort of take a more journalistic approach to the content we were creating in many cases. And I found that, you know, even though I had imagined I would always end up a journalist and work in news, that those same skills were kind of really valuable on the marketing side. And so it was definitely not an intentional journey that I took, but it was one that, you know, sort of I saw the opportunity, I was open to it. And I figured if somebody's going to be creating brand content, it might as well be someone who comes with a journalism background and can lend all those skills and experiences to that process.
We have a fantastic lineup over the next couple of episodes with great conversations with Fred Kopstek on his book, Selling Through Partnering Skills, and many more.
Thank you for being with us today on Bits About Books, where we talk to authors about breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. We hope this conversation helped inform and motivate as we all navigate a rapidly changing business environment. For us, these are enlightening conversations enriched with knowledge and expertise. We encourage you to go out and buy the book to learn firsthand and implement some of the great ideas we discussed today. We hope to have you with us again in the next exciting episode of Bits About Books. If you liked what you heard, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast platforms like iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcast from, and give us a rating while you are at it. This BizCast original podcast is produced for PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform, where the mission is to make buying easy. Hosted by Subhanjan Sarkar and produced by Rajiv Aditya. See you next time and have a wonderful day.